I was concerned about meeting a tight deadline when the editor put me right at ease. She said I had a little wiggle room. I love the wiggle room, even though I've never dwelt in a place that had a room dedicated to wiggling. But I swear my next home will have a wiggle room, and I intend to spend every free moment in there just wiggling the day away. There's more. If all that wanton wiggling leaves me winded, I'll pop into the breathing room. If I'm troubled by excess aggression, it's 30 minutes in the elbow room. But where will I go if I need the practice for the next Iditarod dog sled race? It wouldn't be much of a home if it didn't have a mushroom. I'm Chris Rodell, and this is the Use All the Crayons podcast, the podcast with no discernible format, much less a discernible reason to exist. Well, I've tried to nail one of those down. I've had grand schemes involving guest skits and themes. None has moved the proverbial needle. What's left for a guy like me to do? That's right, take the easy way out. I'm toying with just doing it solo, just me and whatever stories strike my fancy, all stitched together with my best Use All the Crayons tips and quips of the day. These elements will be broken up by a single crisp tone of one of those counterbells they used in the old-timey diners to alert the cranky waitress that the breakfast special was getting cold. So let's see how you like it. I'm doing something that is in defiance of every study on aging that's ever been done. Maturing? Ha! Fat chance of that. No, I'm growing. I've added 5 inches in the past 4 years, at least in the eyes of PennDOT, proving once again that they don't give a damn about the veracity of what you say or do. I decided for my license photo I wanted to become 6 feet tall instead of the puny 5'7" I've been since adolescence. I wrote down 6'2" and got it. My goal is to add at least an inch a year until they take my license. Then I'll swagger down the sidewalk and hear everyone say, "Now there goes a really big man." Tall, too. This was back in 2015. I'll be taking our 10-year-old daughter to the baseball game today because it simultaneously allows me to achieve two things foremost to my existence. One, have fun. Two, brainwash my offspring into believing the old man was once wise and nimble-minded. It's easy for me to do today because I'm a student of the game of baseball. I'll tell Lucy stories of pirate greats Roberto Clemente, Willie Stargell, and Hannes Wagner, and of course Jackie Robinson, eternally famous for breaking baseball's color barrier. The story of the hallowed Robinson is why I'm chagrined I'll be able to tell so little about the forgotten Eddie Klepp. Eddie Klepp was the Jackie Robinson of baseball 11 months before Jackie Robinson became famous for being Jackie Robinson. Klepp broke the color barrier by being the first white player in the Negro Leagues. It happened May 29, 1946, when he pitched 7 innings for the Cleveland Buckeyes in what many sources say was an 8-6 win over the Chicago American Giants. And that's about the only relevant thing I know about this pale pioneer. Sadly, the only other thing I know is, God help us, his life story was sold to Adam Sandler's film company. So it means somewhere, perhaps, in the next 10 years, we'll see an entire movie that'll play out like the fish out of water Dexter Lake Club scene in Animal House. Can we dance with Joe Dates? I read about Klepp, who died in 1981 at the age of 72, and my go-to source for baseball minutia, the On This Day in Baseball feature that runs in the wee print on the days when there's leftover room on the scoreboards. So many questions about Klepp, who was born in Erie in 1918. Robinson was mercilessly heckled, with white fans and opposing teams making monkey sounds and screaming the N-word. Robinson took it all and kicked historic ass. Did anyone heckle Klepp? Was he treated differently? And was he any good? Most sources I see say he was 1-0, which percentage-wise would make him one of the all-time greatest pitchers ever. But the encyclopedic baseballreference.com says Klepp lost his only game, which percentage-wise makes him one of the all-time worst pitchers, and thus suitable candidate to pitch for the Bucks. But what about the man? Was he trying to make a civil rights statement? Did he feel he'd done something significant? Were his fans called kleptomaniacs? It's said he died of alcoholism in 1981. What drove this man to drink? Was he fearful that he'd be remembered? Or was he fearful that he'd be forgotten? I'll bet I know. He had a premonition one day someone like Adam Sandler would be primarily responsible for telling his life story. I'm repeating this one and intend to keep repeating it on a weekly basis or until I sense there's a groundswell of people whose eyes glow with dawning recognition of, oh yeah, now I get it. The full scope of man's well-intentioned folly will be revealed at the posthumous release of a selfie of a wildlife preservationist wearing a Bear With Me t-shirt. Get it? Bear With Me? And he's standing next to a bear. Taken seconds before he is mauled by a grizzly wearing an I'm With Stupid t-shirt. You gotta put it in your mind's eye to get it. I'm about finished with the best book I've read in 10 years. It's Bottom of the 33rd, Hope, Redemption, and Baseball's Longest Game by Dan Barry, 2012. I've read a lot of great books during that time, but this is the first one since Tony Horowitz's Confederates in the Attic that makes me want to buy boxes full to give to friends. It's that good. The longest game in professional baseball history happened April 18, 1981, at McCoy Stadium in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. It was between the Rochester Red Wings and the hometown Red Sox. The game included future Hall of Famers Cal Ripken and Wade Boggs. It was supposed to start at 7:30, but was delayed 30 minutes to correct a lighting malfunction. Once it finally got underway, it went for the next 8 hours until it was... Hang on. This just in. Until it was suspended in the 32nd inning at 4:08 a.m. It was so cold the players began burning bats and benches in trash bins for heat. Pawtucket pitcher Louis Aponte was pulled from the game at 3 a.m. He went home to find his wife was furious and suspected he'd been out drinking. She wouldn't let him in the house. She said, "There's no way a stupid baseball game would ever go that late on Easter morning," he said. Refused entry, and with every place else closed, where did Aponte go? Back to the ballpark to see who won the game. When Boggs, regarded as a selfish showboater by Pawtucket teammates, drove in the tying run at the 21st inning, he said, "There was all this commotion in the dugout. I couldn't tell if they wanted to hug me for tying the game or slug me for tying the game." Rochester outfielder Dallas Williams set a still-standing record for futility for going 0 for 415 at the plate, causing one sports writer to say he had a whole bad month in one day. Only 17 fans remained through the entire game. Major League Baseball rewarded them each with a lifetime pass to any game they ever want to go to again. The gesture caused Pittsburgh's broadcaster Beano Cook to remark, "Haven't they suffered enough?" After a string of frantic calls, the league president suspended the game. After 8 hours, the game was resumed June 23rd, with Pawtucket needing just 18 minutes to finish out the game, the 33rd inning. Future Met star Bob Ojeda was winning pitcher. Rochester's Steve Grilley was the losing pitcher. He's the father of former Pittsburgh standout Jason Grilley. Sorry this went on a little longer than I expected, but these things happen in blogging and baseball. Ozark is a Netflix story about a couple whose ambition is to make money by perpetuating evil. A story about couples whose ambition is to make offspring to perpetuate the species is Noah's Ark. Noah's Ark. This is The Vanity of Telling Time from 2016. The jeweler squinted through his eyepiece magnifying glass and made an offhand pronouncement. "This," he said, "is a very expensive watch." "Or is it?" 2 weeks earlier, the same jeweler had appraised my wife's companion watch and declared hers junk. I wish she'd never asked. Because I enjoyed the watch more once when I was certain it was expensive. Believing I was wearing an expensive watch always made me feel like a real big shot. We'd been given for free the watches aboard a cruise on Lake Henderson in Las Vegas. It was 2005, and I was there on a story about high rollers. Everything was top shelf. I never dreamed our presence would be deemed so illustrious we'd warrant free watches. Those of you familiar with my dainty journalism ethics will recognize here a breach in mine. But I stopped caring about journalism ethics way back when I realized journalism, at least at my level, didn't care about providing a decent salary, so we took the watches without a second thought. And Vegas certainly didn't seem troubled by any ethical considerations, so we were all cool. I do love the watch, even though I only wear it when I want to impress someone with my appearance, which used to happen about once every 2 years, but now happens about once a month. I'll even ponder not getting it fixed. Really, it looks as impressive if it's working or not, and no one knows ever asks anymore what time it is. A nice watch represents two of mankind's most pretentious conceits, vanity and time. Vanity, because we should care more about how we act than how we look. Time, because a watch lets us pretend we can somehow control it. It's why I was inspired to compose the, for me, profound line about this subject. "Foolish mortal, you think you can tell time. Time tells you!" I contend we'd all be better off if we got rid of all the timepieces and just showed up whenever the hell we felt like it. Just be sure to bring a book with you. Books available at www.chrisrodell.com. How does this happen? Has this happened to you? You're supposed to pick up a teenage child at a designated time, say 4:15 p.m. You're within view of the destination. You can actually see the kid, and you get an impatient text. "Where are you?" ? And you look at the car dashboard and see it's 4:16. Too many timepieces and instant communication have warped for the worse our idea of being late. It wasn't that long ago when, if you had said you'd meet someone, you'd ballpark it within an hour or so. Now we synchronize our time like secret agents out to overthrow some third world dictator. And we're surrounded by time. It's on our phones, it's on our walls, it's in our cars, it's on our stereos, it's up in the corner near every screen to which we're practically umbilically attached. The funny thing is about that watch of mine, I wasn't there to get it appraised at all. The battery had died. The jeweler was just making conversation when he vaguely noted its worth. Honest, I sat there in the parking lot wondering if it was even worth getting repaired. It is to me an ornament. It serves the same purpose if it's functioning or not. Rare are the times when I glance at the wristwatch just to learn the time. Time truly is everywhere. We all know the time, we just have no idea where the hell it goes. It's a baffling contradiction. We have no time. We have all the time in the world. I'm unfamiliar with the procedure, whether it involves either seamstress or an exorcist, but I have to imagine when one darns a sock, one is condemning the sock's soul to heck. This is Chris Rodell, Use All the Crayons podcast. We'll be back next week with hopefully fewer delays in the discussions. And remember, learn the fine art of knowing precisely when to quit.